Starbucks anti-bias training yesterday was closed to the media. Starbucks closed about 8,000 company-owned stores to provide employees mandatory anti-bias training. This training comes after two black men were arrested for trespassing at a Starbucks last month. They were later let go. We're taking a deeper look at the impact of workplace diversity training here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Psychologist Will Cox studies stereotypes and prejudice as an assistant scientist in the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab, which is part of the Department of Psychology at UW-Madison. Will, welcome to the program.
Hi, glad to be here.
Well, can you start by explaining for us this concept of implicit bias or unintentional bias? What is it?
Well, growing up in our culture through the media and from our parents, we learned stereotypes and ideas about members of different social groups. It's basically unavoidable. Kids as young as 5 and 6 can articulate what the stereotypes about different groups are. And so these stereotypes get ingrained in our minds and become just an automatic, some automatic cognition that pops up when we encounter members of different groups. And it can very often influence people's behaviors without their awareness and often in opposition to their intentions to behave in unbiased ways.
So I understand UW-Madison has really been a leader in studying implicit bias. What do we know there?
So actually Dr. Patricia Devine, who I work with and have worked with for the last 12 years, the very idea of unintentional bias came from her early work back in the 80s, demonstrating that race can influence people without them being aware of it. And then she built a career of work looking at the struggles people face when well-intentioned egalitarian people find themselves influenced by this unintentional bias and what they do to try to address and regulate that. And then building up to the last 10 years, we've put a lot of that work into the form of an intervention we call the prejudice habit-breaking intervention that teaches people about unintentional bias. We talk about it as a type of a habit of mind and kind of walk people through the steps of trying to break that habit and reduce bias that might appear.
And we're going to get to that in just a bit here about how these types of training interventions work and whether they work. But how do you respond to people who say there's no way they could be biased because they don't have, quote unquote, a racist or sexist bone in their body? Maybe they do social justice work or that they come from a diverse background. And so this idea of being biased might be very difficult for them to accept.
It can be difficult for many people because, like you say, if someone believes, if their personal values say that racism is wrong and so on, it's hard for them to think about this. So I really explain it as this is just kind of an ordinary part of how our brains work and how our minds work. This is something that everyone has these types of biases, not just people from historically powerful groups, not just white straight men and so on. This is something that is a byproduct of how your brain processes and stores information that can affect everyone, but it doesn't have to affect you if you put effort into overcoming it.
So as we look at the situation with Starbucks, and of course, we have heard a lot in the media about the effort on behalf of Starbucks closing down a lot of its stores, having its employees go through this training. But the situation there that this stemmed from in April, where these two police were called on these two black customers who didn't do anything, but the manager was saying they weren't buying anything, and therefore, you know, this was a situation of trespassing. So are we confusing perhaps regular bias for implicit or unintentional bias? What is the breakdown there?
Yeah, so that's something that me and some of my colleagues have been talking about a lot. So with any given real world situation, it's hard to kind of parse out, well, is this just a person who doesn't like black people and is just expressing explicit bias? Or it could be a situation where unintentional bias kind of started a process that was recursive. You know, the fact that the gentlemen were black could have activated, you know, ideas of them being criminal or fear responses that kind of then spiraled up until the final incident. So it could go either way, you know, without knowing more about the person and so on. I wouldn't venture a guess.
So there could have been like this escalation of bias, if you will.
Oh, absolutely. Like either unintentional or intentional forms of bias could have contributed to that final outcome. Yeah.
We're talking right now with Will Cox. He is a psychologist at the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab in the Department of Psychology at UW-Madison. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Have you gone through anti-bias training? What did you think about it? Did you learn something? Was it enlightening or not? Did your behavior or way of thinking change after going through this kind of training? Is it offered through your company? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So looking at the Starbucks closing up yesterday, holding this training for employees, this kind of workplace training has become fairly common among companies, especially large companies, Walmart and Target in particular. They are actually doing more of it. Can you speak to what a typical anti-bias training looks like or what the most common models for this kind of training are?
So very often these trainings tend to focus on helping people understand that they could fall prey to bias and help them understand what the impact of that bias is on others. And those are admirable goals. And I think companies like Starbucks and Walmart and others have very good intentions when they roll out these kinds of trainings. But very often that's not enough. And what some of the research says is that trainings like that very often don't do much in terms of impacting the climate of the companies. And sometimes they actually make problems worse. So if we're talking about racial bias specifically, very often they get white people to understand the potential for expressing bias in unintended ways, but then they don't give them evidence-based tools for how to address that and how to behave in less biased ways. And so then the white people kind of freeze up. They don't want to express bias, but they don't know what else to do. And so they often will, for instance, avoid their minority coworkers because they don't want to say something unintentionally biased. And that actually contributes to a more negative environment for those minority workers. And so it's something that's been of great interest to me and other scientists in this field lately.
And so you can actually track that, see that happening through these trainings, that these are the results?
In some of the cases where they actually track what the impact is, predominantly they don't actually do the type of assessment you would need to understand the impact. But when that work has been done, at best these trainings do nothing, and at worst they actually make the problems worse.
So how are you seeing companies change then or address this, or how have these types of trainings evolved over the past dozen years or so?
I think there's been an increase in the prevalence of these trainings. I haven't seen much change in their type of content or anything like that. Mm. Over the last 10 years, we developed an intervention that we've been testing in the laboratory and more recently exporting to the world that actually is having some promising findings and showing long-term effects. But that's not something that is widespread yet.
So why is this workplace sort of the default place for anti-bias training? Why is it companies or the place we work? For example, why don't we see it more in perhaps churches or schools or other community settings?
That's an interesting question. I think that very often workplaces, like Starbucks, a problem arises, an incident arises, and they want to address it. And I think that is coming from a very genuine, well-intentioned place. I don't think it's just trying to manage PR. I think Starbucks really cares about these issues, but very often it follows an incident like this, and that they're seeking to address it in some way.
Well, Starbucks had attempted an organized conversation around race relations before, back in 2015, its Race Together campaign. encouraged baristas to strike up conversations with customers about their racial and ethnic backgrounds, but that effort was criticized. We're talking about anti-bias training here on The Morning Show. Social psychologist Will Cox is with us. He studies prejudice in the psychology department at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gone through implicit bias training? What did you think about it? Did your behavior or your way of thinking change after going through this kind of training? In what way? Do you remember a situation where your biases perhaps got in the way and affected your judgment? Could you even see that happening? What do you think when you think about back to that situation now? Call in. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this news update right here on the Ideas Network. A spokeswoman for Starbucks said all company-owned stores and employees received the same curriculum yesterday afternoon. And the company stressed that the training is one step in an ongoing process. We're talking about the impact this type of training makes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Psychologist Will Cox stays with us. His research at the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab at UW-Madison focuses on uncovering cultural, social, cognitive, and neural mechanisms that perpetuate stereotypes and prejudice. We're breaking it all down with your questions, your insights in the mix at 800-642-1234. Do you think all workplaces should have implicit bias training for their employees, or should this kind of training not be taking place in the workplace to begin with? Do you commend Starbucks for doing this training, or do you think the company is doing it to improve its public image? Call in. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Will, can you talk about what your lab is doing to kind of rewrite and package this type of training and this type of intervention?
So for the last 12 years, we've worked to develop basically from scratch, not really trying to change other people's bias and diversity interventions, but kind of building from scratch a model of what needs to happen for people to make meaningful changes in their expressions of bias. And so what our intervention does, it teaches people about where unintentional bias comes from, how it's an ordinary mental process. And we liken it to a sort of a habit, a mental habit. And similar to other habits, there are a few steps you have to take if you want to try and break a habit and change your habitual way of thinking. And so you have to become aware of the ways the bias can play out. You need concrete strategies for something you can actually do to change the habit, and you need to put effort into it over time. And so we walk people through just this basic model of how unintentional bias is a habit and how to break it, and actually teach them a set of concrete strategies that have been empirically shown to reduce the likelihood of expressing bias in the future, and then give people this model that they can take forward and, if they so choose, apply in their daily lives to work on behaving and thinking in less biased ways. And then over the past 12 years, we've actually tested this intervention in randomized controlled experiments, which is what you have to do if you want to really show that your intervention is causing changes. You have to have a control group that people are randomly assigned to, so you can compare people who get your intervention to those who don't. And over the last 10 years, we've done many of these randomized controlled trials with versions of this intervention with positive effects lasting out to 2 months, and in some recent data, we've shown 2 years later, people who have gone through our intervention are still applying the tools they learned and standing up to bias and displaying less bias up to 2 years later.
So what are some of these concrete strategies that people can deploy in their lives and their everyday life?
So one of the strategies is called seeking out individuating information. So one of the things that stereotypes and biases do is when you don't have a lot of information about someone, they kind of fill in the gaps. If I'm telling you about my friend Emily and she's female. The stereotype of what women are supposed to be like will kind of fill in your picture of what she's like. But if I give you more detailed individuating information, if I tell you that she likes horseback riding and she's good at math and statistics and so on, the more details you have about her, the less the stereotypes and biases are going to affect your perception of her. So in workplace situations and hiring situations, for instance, one of the strategies is just getting more of that individuating information as you're making an impression of someone, and it kind of prevents bias from being able to seep in as much.
There are some online tests that people can take to find out what their perhaps level of bias is or where their bias is. The implicit association test is a widely used test to measure implicit bias. Do these types of tests work?
So there's a lot of debate about what those tests assess, but for our purposes, I find those tests to be very useful educational tools, because as you go through the implicit association test, you can really feel how your kind of brain and your habitual way of responding is kind of pulling you in one direction over another. And so I think that they can be very useful for just kind of understanding how these automatic processes, unintentional biases, are really there in your brain.
So it's more like developing awareness.
Exactly. That's exactly how we talk about it. So giving people, the people that you mentioned earlier, who in their conscious minds are not racist, not biased, and maybe don't want to entertain the possibility that they could be unintentionally biased. And so we often use the implicit association test to kind of demonstrate these automatic processes that can be at play under the surface.
So can a test like this, just being able to identify and measure your own bias, is that a way of helping people overcome their biases? Does it make an impact?
It does for many people, but it's only a first step. Because if you make people aware, but then don't give them something that they can do to work on it, then it can just be very, some people will just feel defeated because they'll be like, well, there's nothing I can do about it. I have this. And that's just the end of it. So our intervention is designed to kind of connect that awareness, to use it to motivate people, and then actually give them this toolkit of strategies that can help them work on reducing the bias.
Oftentimes, this diversity training is happening in group settings, and people are usually, perhaps, forced to divulge some of their personal observations in their own worlds. They maybe have to open up more in a group setting. Does the setting of this training make an impact on whether it works or not?
It can. So for our training, we've done kind of both individualized versions where people are listening to it, you know, on a computer by themselves, or in group settings. The thing we try to be most cautious of in the group settings is that we try to be very careful about the power dynamics there. So if it's employees and they're sitting there with their direct supervisors and bosses, they might be uncomfortable and not willing to speak up and share experiences they've had. But I think either group or individual settings can be effective for this, for people who are motivated to work on these issues.
Well, watching diversity training on a computer where you're watching a series of situations play out that are, on a video screen in front of you, is that too far removed from real life to make an impact, or is that employee truly engaged in the moment when they know what they're watching on the screen is a scenario? It's not real life.
I'd have to see the specific trainings that have the scenarios on the computer screen. Mm-hmm. The version of our intervention I was talking about that's on the computer screen, it's the same model that I described earlier. And actually what we find is that most people are well-intentioned and don't want to behave in biased ways. And the way we set up our training actually engages them, and they find it useful for their daily lives. So they kind of choose to engage. We've made it as engaging as possible. Mm-hmm. And people see how the tools we are giving them can be useful, and they actually choose to put them and take them into their lives. So for our computerized training, I think people do engage with it well. Not everyone, I'm sure, but...
So the person has to be open and willing to certainly accept that training.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, someone who is not doesn't care about these issues at all and is maybe explicitly biased or not interested, that these kinds of interventions aren't going to reach them one way or another.
Talking with UW-Madison psychologist Will Cox as our guide as we look at anti-bias training in the workforce on the heels of Starbucks closing its doors yesterday afternoon to have its employees go through this type of training. Your insights, 800-642-1234. Do you commend Starbucks for doing this training with its employees, or do you think the company was doing this to improve its image? Have you experienced bias because of your gender, race, religion, or anything else? What was that like? And how have those experiences changed you, shaped you? 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Paul in Eau Claire has an email saying, is it risky telling people they are implicitly biased? Wouldn't that breed resentment and actual racism if you tell people it's their natural state?
That's definitely not how I would frame it personally. I think that there are some people who would take the kind of unintentional form of bias and use it as an excuse in the way that that person is describing. But I think most people, when they're made aware of it and they understand that it's an ordinary part of cognitive processing and how our brains work, they're interested in addressing it. And so it's not saying that this is an inevitable thing, because part of what our group is teaching people is your brain might be inclined towards perpetuating bias and being biased, but your mind can be harnessed to help regulate and change that. So I don't think it's risky in the long term, because it's sort of the truth, and it's what we have, the situation we have to deal with. So avoiding it probably wouldn't be the best approach.
Karen on Facebook is asking, can you address Roseanne Barr's racist tweet comparing a former senior Obama advisor who's black to an ape? How does comedy, which is often by definition offensive, fit into the discussion around bias and racism?
Well, that's actually one of my areas of research, looking at how humor is used to perpetuate stereotypes and biases. First off, let me just say that Roseanne's tweet was absolutely horrendous and offensive, and she's an adult and should know a lot better. And I think that the network canceling her show, I think it's unfortunate for the other employees on the show, but I'm proud of them, or I commend their actions. So one of the issues with humor and these sorts of things is very often if someone finds it funny and finds an offensive comment funny, then when someone finds it offensive, they'll be like, oh, you don't have a good sense of humor, you just can't take a joke, etc. And they'll kind of dismiss concerns about the joke perpetuating types of bias. And very often framing a biased message or a stereotype perpetuating message or something just heinously prejudiced, like comparing people of color to apes, like Roseanne did, framing it in a joke is a way for people to make it seem more acceptable, at least to the people who find that funny. And so it leads to the bias spreading more than if they were just saying, oh, I believe that people of color are like this, or what have you. So I think the realm of humor is interesting and potentially very pernicious for perpetuating these sorts of processes. And that's some of what my lab has been studying lately, actually.
Let's go to Ken joining us from Black River Falls. Hi, Ken.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Very interesting show. I will tell you briefly a story. When I was about 10 years old, I was living with my family, obviously, down in South Jersey. I used to go down to Camden in the summertime with my father to do chores down at his office building. One day, we're about the corner of 6th and Penn Street, and I looked to my right, and I see a little black kid who's being given his lunch basket by his lunch bag by his mom, cap put on his head, gives him a hug and a kiss, and sends him on his way for his summer activities. Over another block, my father asked me, do you happen to notice that little boy? And I said, yes, why? He said, I want you to know something. Remember this. His mother loves him as much as your mother loves you. We 10 years old hearing this. And
wow, that made quite an impression.
Well, let me finish. I then said, why do you mention this? And he said, because you have to remember that all people, and he emphasized all, have a tendency to be biased. They will make a distinction. I'm better than that person. I'm this, I'm that, and the other, based on race, based on wealth, based on any number of things. He said, that's the dark side of human nature. We keep driving. I'm thinking about this. I'm 10. I said, is there a bright side to human nature? He said, yes, there is. You know you have a dark side, and when you feel that coming up, you stop it. That's the bright side. And I remember that story every day of my life over 62 years ago, and it applies, and it's a fairly quick way to realize, yeah, you got biases, but you got to be aware of them, and you got to stop them.
Ken, thank you so much for sharing that story at a young age. Wilcox, go ahead.
Oh, that's beautiful. I wish more people had that lesson when they were young. It's a great encapsulation of what I try to share with people. So thank you. Beautiful.
What role does the media play in implicit bias? The images selected, the stories covered?
Oh, a huge role. So, researchers in communication arts and communication sciences do these things that we call media content analyses, where they systematically assess what gets covered in the news and how things are covered in the news. And we see consistently that Black people are portrayed in more negative ways, more criminal ways. In one study done in California, if a white person committed a crime compared to a Black person who was allegedly committed a crime, the news was more likely, 50% more likely to show a picture when it was a Black person who was the alleged perpetrator of the crime than if it was a white person. And so then it gives this mistaken, imbalanced perception that more Black people are committing crimes than white people, when in fact the real statistic is that white people are if you're the victim of a crime, it's much more likely that it was committed by a white person, just because there are more white people. But what you see in the news gives the impression that it is more often Black people committing crimes. And there have been many studies like this in many different domains of media that show that the media is one of the biggest factors in people learning stereotypes and developing unintentional biases in the first place.
Well, Lauren on Facebook says what we need is more diverse hiring at the management level, because bias cannot be unlearned in an afternoon. Lauren says as long as people like that manager in Pennsylvania are in positions of power, they'll continue to call the police. And the police, who perhaps did not attend anti-bias training, will continue to reward people with racial bias. When there is an actual consequence for exhibiting bias, that's when we might see change. What insights do you glean there?
I overall agree. So more hiring at all levels, more diverse hiring at all levels, I think would be helpful. I think that person who called the police did have some pretty serious consequences. I mean, we wouldn't be here talking about it if there weren't consequences for those actions. And I think that's a good thing. With regard to the, you know, one afternoon of training, they're absolutely correct. One afternoon of training is not itself going to just completely change a company or completely change a person. But with the intervention that we've worked with, what we find, and I'm repeating myself a little, is that people take what they learn and then apply it in their lives. This addressing bias is not going to be anything that you can just take a pill or wave a magic wand and then bias is over. It takes work day after day, year after year to address these things. And so if we can give people tools that they apply in their lives and take with them and use every day, that's where we can create change. And that's somewhere where an afternoon of training could put people on that path.
We're talking with... Yeah, we're talking with UW-Madison psychologist Will Cox, our guide. Your questions, your perceptions about this type of training are welcome. 800-642-1234. Back after this on the Ideas Network. The Perception Institute is a group of researchers consulting with Starbucks. They define implicit bias as attitudes, positive or negative, or stereotype someone has toward a person or group without being conscious of it. Common example, according to some of its studies, is this tendency for white people to unknowingly associate black people with criminal behavior. We're talking about workplace diversity training and what impact it has on how we view the world. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Psychologist Will Cox stays with us. He's an assistant scientist in the psychology department at UW-Madison. His work is in the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab there. Gathering your questions, your insights at 800-642-1234. Do you remember a situation where your biases were perhaps in the way and affected your judgment, affected your outcome? What do you think when you look back at that situation now? Do you think all workplaces should have implicit bias training for their employees? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in George joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Good morning. I think a lot of employees see these kinds of trainings and other trainings that they feel sometimes forced to attend as just the management's latest fad, and that management doesn't really have much skin in the game themselves, that they don't really take this seriously, that sometimes it's just being done for PR. And so I'm wondering if your guest can mention other things that large organizations that employ people can take to make sure that their employees feel that that the organization as such is taking this seriously, more than just a two-hour session.
George, thanks for that. Will Cox, what else is out there?
Not much, really, sadly. I think that his observation is actually very common. It's something that people bring up a lot. Many employees, many companies do these trainings, and employees see them as just a waste of time and something that, yeah, the employer's latest fad. So you have to have a training that inspires the employees not to see it that way. And you have to have commitment from at all levels of the organization to say, you know, this is what our values say, and this is something that we're committed to. And then you have to have a training that you know is actually going to help promote that kind of culture in your organization. And it takes a lot of effort and a lot of background research to know that these trainings are going to work. And thus far, not many people have put that kind of effort into validating the trainings that are out there.
Anne in La Crosse emailed and said, waiting until people are in the workplace is too late. This needs to begin in elementary schools to have a real impact.
I think that would be great. It definitely. So what we find is that these stereotypes and biases are pretty well learned by the time kids are even old enough to question them. And so there's always a head start that the stereotypes and biases have, because kids don't have the moral reasoning to question that kind of thinking earlier on when they're first learning stereotypes. And so I think intervening earlier on in elementary school is a great idea. One of my close colleagues, Catherine Scott, in the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab, she's working on interventions to work with parents and teachers and how they talk to students and their kids, how parents talk to their kids about race and other things earlier on, with the hope of doing just that.
Let's go to Gary joining us from Merrill. Hi, Gary.
Yes, good morning. See, with every type of color and nationality included now, the heavy minority status, is there going to be some point at which white males have some kind of minority status? Because we are left out with jobs and all kinds of benefits. The other thing with Starbucks, you lose the whole point of the discussion here. The two men weren't asked to leave Starbucks because of their race. They were asked to leave because it's private property, and they were on there, they were in the store without buying anything. So it had nothing to do with their race. It's just that they didn't abide by the same rules that everybody else does.
Gary, so two points there Gary is making. But the first, that everyone is a minority, including white males, that white males are being discriminated against in society. Will Cox, where would you go with that?
So I would say that if you look at the systematic data, that it's much more rare that white men are discriminated against the same way as other groups. That doesn't mean it can't happen. But on by and large, it's much less common and less systematic than what we see black people and women facing. I think it's something to keep an eye on because we don't want anyone to be disadvantaged by their group status.
The train. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to talk about the second
part. Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
So it's complicated because in any given case, we can't completely know the role that race plays. So it could be the case that two white people in that Starbucks with that manager displaying those behaviors would have called the police on them as well. But when you step back and look across situations, what we see in the data is that black people face those kinds of outcomes much more than white people do. Those sorts of things happen disproportionately to black people more than white people. So it could be the case that there are instances where white people would have had the same outcome, but overall, those outcomes are much more likely if you're a person of color.
Starbucks made a point of saying that this particular training was the first step in a number of steps. So what might a second step look like after you've done an afternoon of training with about 8,000 employees?
I don't know what Starbucks has planned, but continuing the conversation is one of the things that we emphasize a lot. Working with your coworkers, your supervisors, and so on to discuss racial issues as they occur, but also before they occur. Just make diversity and overcoming bias part of the daily conversation in your corporate culture. Those are all things to keep this at the forefront of people's minds, to keep people working on these issues. It's the effort over time that in the end will make a difference.
Starbucks did try to roll out this campaign in 2015, leaning on baristas to start conversations with patrons around race, and that didn't go so well. What do we know there about, trying to strike up conversations with customers about their racial and ethnic backgrounds?
Yeah, that sounds very awkward to me. I wasn't aware of that program when it rolled out, but if you're having conversations about race, they need to come from a genuine place, and they need to be perceived as very genuine. And I think this kind of like pressure to just strike up a conversation about race with a stranger and it's a stranger who's just trying to get their coffee, I think that that's just going to be perceived as really awkward and strange. These things have to happen a little more naturally. I think being open to talking about race is great, but just walking up to the customers of color and saying, hey, tell me about your race and ethnicity, I think that is just very uncomfortable and awkward.
Let's go to Lori joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the gentleman earlier, Gary, I believe his name was, who said that white males are now being discriminated against. They're not being discriminated against. They've just been so entitled all these years that they expect it to go on instead of letting other people have their rights, too, the women and the minorities.
Lori, thanks for the call. And Wilcox, what about diversifying your workforce and hiring more people from all backgrounds?
So there's research showing that when you have people of different backgrounds, people with different perspectives, actually your workforce can be more productive. New ideas and innovations tend to come from people who have different perspectives on a problem working together. So in that way, diversifying can actually benefit workforces in very concrete ways. And in general, I think we just want people to have all the opportunities that could be available to them regardless of their background. So, and diversifying is having a more diverse work group is one step on that road.
So what are the larger overarching goals here of bias reduction training? Where are we going to? What is our destination?
So that's actually one of the big problems with the trainings that are out there. They don't always have very clear goals, or they don't articulate the goals and evaluate the extent to which what the training does is actually going to make progress towards the goals. And that's where just kind of more research and kind of focus needs to happen. So with our training is very specifically focused on giving individuals the tools to address bias and reduce the influence of bias in their own minds, and then work on it in their kind of immediate social context. It's not supposed to fix all the problems at once. But many bias and diversity trainings out there, they are trying to see if they can fix everything in one training, and they end up kind of diluting their efforts a bit.
So it becomes a really ambitious thing to do in the course of perhaps 2 to 3 hours in an afternoon.
Absolutely. It loses focus. And so our training, you know, one of the criticisms some people level against it is like, well, you're not trying to address societal, institutional level racism and bias, changing policies and so on. And we just agree with that. Ours is very focused on the individual and what they can do in their own minds. Other approaches are needed for changing policies at institutions, for addressing issues in the media and with police and so on. But I think if people can clarify and make specific the goals they have in a training and then evaluate whether the training is making progress towards those goals, all of these diversity and bias trainings would probably be better off for it.
Well, as we wrap up here, where does your research go next, very quickly?
So my research looks at these interventions, but also looks at how the brain's learning mechanisms perpetuates bias so that we can better understand how to improve the trainings. And so I've been looking a lot at how the brain's reward system plays out in stereotyping in a way that kind of makes it very compulsive and hard to overcome. And so that's what I've been working on lately.
Well, Will, thank you so much for your time.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Psychologist Will Cox studies stereotypes and prejudice as an assistant scientist in the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab, which is part of the Department of Psychology at UW-Madison. This hour of The Morning Show was produced by Colleen Leahy and Ideas Network Director Cheryl Gasser. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.